This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman, written and read by Nora Ephron.
I feel bad about my neck. I feel bad about my neck. Truly, I do. If you saw my neck, you might feel bad about it too, but you'd probably be too polite to let on. If I said something to you on the subject, something like, I absolutely cannot stand my neck, you'd undoubtedly respond by saying something nice, like, I don't know what you're talking about. You'd be lying, of course, but I forgive you. I tell lies like that all the time, mostly to friends who tell me they're upset because they have little pouches under their eyes, or jowls, or wrinkles, or flab around the middle, and do I think they should have an eye job or a facelift or Botox or liposuction. My experience is that I don't know what you're talking about is code for, I see what you mean, but if you think you're going to trap me into engaging on this subject, you're crazy. It's dangerous to engage on such subjects, and we all know it. Because if I said, yes, I see exactly what you mean, my friend might go out and have her eyes done, for instance, and it might not work. And she might end up being one of those people you read about in tabloids who ends up in court suing their plastic surgeons because they can never close their eyes again. Furthermore, and this is the point, it would be all my fault. I am particularly sensitive to the all my fault aspect of things, since I have never forgiven one of my friends for telling me not to buy a perfectly good apartment on East 75th Street in 1976. Sometimes I go out to lunch with my girlfriends. I got that far into the sentence and caught myself. I suppose I mean my women friends. We are no longer girls and have not been girls for 40 years. Anyway, sometimes we go out to lunch and I look around the table and realize we're all wearing turtleneck sweaters. Sometimes, instead, we're all wearing scarves, like Katharine Hepburn in On Golden Pond. Sometimes we're all wearing mandarin collars and look like a white lady's version of the Joy Luck Club. It's sort of funny, and it's sort of sad, because we're not neurotic about age. None of us lies about how old she is, for instance, and none of us dresses in a way that's inappropriate for our years. We all look good for our age, except for our necks. Oh, the necks. There are chicken necks. There are turkey gobbler necks. There are elephant necks. There are necks with wattles and necks with creases that are on the verge of becoming wattles. There are scrawny necks and fat necks, loose necks, crepey necks, banded necks, wrinkled necks, stringy necks, saggy necks, flabby necks, mottled necks. There are necks that are an amazing combination of all of the above. According to my dermatologist, the neck starts to go at 43, and that's that. You can put makeup on your face and concealer under your eyes and dye on your hair. You can shoot collagen and Botox and Restylane into your wrinkles and creases, but short of surgery, there is not a damn thing you can do about a neck. The neck is a dead giveaway. Our faces are lies, and our necks are the truth. You have to cut open a redwood tree to see how old it is, but you wouldn't have to if it had a neck. My own experience with my neck began shortly before I turned 43. I had an operation that left me with a terrible scar just above the collarbone. It was shocking, because I learned the hard way that just because a doctor was a famous surgeon didn't mean he had any gift for sewing people up. If you learn nothing else from this essay, dear reader, learn this. Never have an operation on any part of your body without asking a plastic surgeon to come stand by in the operating room and keep an eye out. Because even if you are being operated on for something serious or potentially serious, Even if you honestly believe that your health is more important than vanity, even if you wake up in the hospital room thrilled beyond imagining that it wasn't cancer, even if you feel elated, grateful to be alive, full of blinding insight about what's important and what's not, even if you vow to be eternally joyful about being on the planet Earth and promise never to complain about anything ever again, I promise you that one day, soon, sooner than you can imagine, you will look in the mirror and think, I hate this scar. Assuming, of course, that you look in the mirror. That's another thing about being a certain age that I've noticed. I try as much as possible not to look in the mirror. If I pass a mirror, I avert my eyes. If I must look into it, I begin by squinting, so that if anything really bad is looking back at me, I am already halfway to closing my eyes to ward off the sight. And if the light is good, which I hope it's not, I often do what so many women my age do when stuck in front of a mirror. I gently pull the skin of my neck back and stare wistfully at a younger version of myself. Here's something else I've noticed, by the way. If you want to get really, really depressed about your neck, sit in the back seat of a car right behind the driver and look at yourself in the rearview mirror. What is it about rearview mirrors? I have no idea why, but there are no worse mirrors where necks are concerned. It's one of the genuinely compelling mysteries of modern life, right up there with why the cold water in the bathroom is colder than the cold water in the kitchen. But my neck. This is about my neck. And I know what you're thinking. Why not go to a plastic surgeon? I'll tell you why not. If you go to a plastic surgeon and say, I'd like you just to fix my neck, he will tell you flat out that he can't do it without giving you a facelift too. And he's not lying. He's not trying to con you into spending more money. The fact is, it's all one big ball of wax. If you tighten up the neck, you've also got to tighten up the face. But I don't want a facelift. If I were a muffin and had a nice round puffy face, I would bite the bullet. Muffins are perfect candidates for this sort of thing. But I am, alas, a bird. And if I had a facelift, my neck would be improved, no question. But my face would end up pulled and tight. I would rather squint at this sorry face and neck of mine in the mirror, then confront a stranger who looks suspiciously like a drum pad. Every so often I read a book about age, and whoever's writing it says it's great to be old. It's great to be wise and sage and mellow. It's great to be at the point where you understand just what matters in life. I can't stand people who say things like this. What can they be thinking? Don't they have necks? Aren't they tired of compensatory dressing? Don't they mind that 90% of the clothes they might otherwise buy have to be eliminated simply because of the necklines? Don't they feel sad about having to buy chokers? One of my biggest regrets, bigger even than not buying the apartment on East 75th Street, bigger even than my worst romantic catastrophe, is that I didn't spend my youth staring lovingly at my neck. It never crossed my mind to be grateful for it. It never crossed my mind that I would be nostalgic about a part of my body that I took completely for granted. Of course, it's true that now that I'm older, I'm wise and sage and mellow. And it's also true that I honestly do understand just what matters in life. But guess what? It's my neck. I hate my purse. I hate my purse. I absolutely hate it. If you're one of those women who thinks there's something great about purses, don't even bother listening to this because there will be nothing here for you. This is for women who hate their purses, who are bad at purses, who understand that their purses are reflections of negligent housekeeping, hopeless disorganization, a chronic inability to throw anything away, and an ongoing failure to handle the obligations of a demanding and difficult accessory. The obligation, for example, that it should in some way match what you're wearing. This is for women whose purses are a morass of loose Tic Tacs, solitary Advils, lipsticks without tops, chapsticks of unknown vintage, little bits of tobacco, even though there has been no smoking going on for at least 10 years, tampons that have come loose from their wrappings, English coins from a trip to London last October, boarding passes from long-forgotten airplane trips, hotel keys from God knows what hotel, leaky ballpoint pens, Kleenexes that either have or have not been used, but there's no way to be sure one way or another, scratched eyeglasses, an old tea bag, several crumpled personal checks that have come loose from the checkbook and are covered with smudge marks, and an unprotected toothbrush that looks as if it has been used to polish silver. This is for women who in mid-July realize they still haven't bought a summer purse, or who in mid-winter are still carrying around a straw bag. This is for women who find it appalling that a purse might cost $500 or $600, never mind that top-of-the-line thing called a Birkin bag that costs $10,000, not that it's relevant, because you can't even get on the waiting list for one. On the waiting list for a purse, for a $10,000 purse that will end up full of old Tic Tacs. This is for those of you who understand, in short, that your purse is in some absolutely horrible way you. Or, as Louis XIV might have put it, but didn't because he was much too smart to have a purse, le sac, c'est moi. I realized many years ago that I was no good at purses, and for quite a while I managed to do without one. I was a freelance writer, and I spent most of my time at home. I didn't need a purse to walk into my own kitchen. When I went out, usually at night, I frequently managed with only a lipstick, a $20 bill, and a credit card tucked into my pocket. That's about all you can squeeze into an evening bag anyway, and it saved me a huge amount of money because I didn't have to buy an evening bag. Evening bags, for reasons that are obscure unless you're a Marxist, cost even more than regular bags. But unfortunately, there were times when I needed to leave the house with more than the basics. I solved this problem by purchasing an overcoat with large pockets. This, I realize, turned my coat into a purse, but it was still better than carrying a purse. Anything is better than carrying a purse. Because here's what happens with a purse. You start small. You start pledging yourself to neatness. You start vowing that this time it will be different. You start with the things you absolutely need. Your wallet and a few cosmetics that you have actually put into a brand new shiny cosmetics bag, the kind used by your friends who are competent enough to manage more than one purse at a time. But within seconds, your purse has accumulated the debris of a lifetime. The cosmetics have somehow fallen out of the shiny cosmetics bag. Okay, you forgot to zip it up. The coins have fallen from the wallet. Okay, you forgot to fasten the coin compartment. The credit cards are somewhere in the abyss. Okay, you forgot to put your Visa card back into your wallet after you bought the sunblock that is now oozing into the lining because you forgot to put the top back onto it after you applied it to your hands while driving 70 miles an hour down the highway. What's more, a huge amount of space in your purse is being taken up by a technological marvel that holds your address book and calendar, or would, but the batteries in it have died. And there's half a bottle of water, along with several snacks you saved from an airplane trip, just in case you ever found yourself starving and unaccountably craving a piece of cheese that tastes like plastic. Perhaps you can fit your sneakers into your purse. Yes, by God, you can. Before you know it, your purse weighs 20 pounds and you are in grave danger of getting bursitis and needing an operation just from carrying it around. Everything you own is in your purse. You could flee the Cossacks with your purse. But when you open it up, you can't find a thing in it. Your purse is just a big, dark hole full of stuff that you spend hours fishing around for. A flashlight would help, but if you were to put one into your purse, you'd never find it. What's the solution? I'm no longer a freelance writer who sits home all day. I need stuff. I need stuff for work. I need cosmetics to tide me over. I need a book to keep me company. I need, sad to say, a purse. For a while, I searched for an answer. Like those Hollywood women who are willing to fling themselves into the Kabbalah or Scientology or yoga, I read just about any article about purses that promised me some sort of salvation from this misery. At one point, I thought, perhaps the solution is not one purse, but two. So I tried having two purses, one for personal things and one for work things. Yes, I know, the second purse is usually called a briefcase. This system works for most people, but not for me, and for a fairly obvious reason which I've already disclosed. I'm not an organized human being. Another solution I tried involves spending quite a lot of money on a purse, on the theory that having an expensive purse would inspire me to change my personality. But that didn't work either. I also tried one of those Prada-style semi-backpack purses, but I bought it just when it was going out of fashion, and in any case, I put so much into it that I looked like a Sherpa. And then, one day, I found myself in Paris with a friend who announced that her goal for the week was to buy a Kelly bag. Perhaps you know what a Kelly bag is. I didn't. I had never heard of one. What is a Kelly bag? I asked. My friend looked at me as if I had spent the century asleep in a cave. And she explained. A Kelly bag is an Hermes bag first made in the 1950s that Grace Kelly made famous, hence the name. It is a classic. It is the purse equivalent of the world's most perfect string of pearls. It's still being manufactured, but my friend didn't want a new one. She wanted a vintage Kelly bag. She'd heard that there was a dealer in the flea market who had several for sale. The flea market is open on weekends only, so we spent several days eating, drinking, sightseeing, all of it, as far as my friend was concerned, mere prelude to the main event. How much is this purse going to cost? I asked. I practically expired when she told me. About $3,000. $3,000 for an old purse. Plus, if you're counting, which I was, plane fare. Well, finally we went to the flea market, and there was the Kelly bag. I didn't know what to say. It looked like the sort of bag my mother used to carry. It barely held anything, and it hung stiffly on my friend's arm. I may not be good at purses, but I know that any purse that hangs stiffly on your arm instead of on your shoulder adds 10 years, and furthermore immobilizes half your body. In a modern world, your arms have to be free. I don't want to get too serious here, but a purse, like a pair of high heels, actually impinges on your mobility. That's one of the many reasons why you don't see the guys with purses trend catching on. If one of your hands is stuck carrying your purse, it means it's not free for all sorts of exciting things you could be using it for, like shoving your way through crowds, throwing your arms around loved ones, climbing the greasy pole to success and waving madly for taxis. Anyway, my friend bought her Kelly bag. She paid $2,600 for it. The color wasn't exactly what she wanted, but it was in wonderful shape. Of course, it would have to be waterproofed immediately because it would lose half its value if it got caught in the rain. Waterproofed. Caught in the rain? It had never crossed my mind to worry about a purse being caught in the rain, much less being waterproofed. For a moment, I thought once again about how my mother had failed to teach me anything about purses, and I almost felt sorry for myself. But it was time for lunch. The two of us went to a bistro, and the Kelly bag was placed in the center of the table, where it sat like a small shrine to a shopping victory. And then, outside, it began to rain. My friend's eyes began to well with tears. Her lips closed tightly. In fact, to be completely truthful, her lips actually pursed. It was pouring rain, and she hadn't had the Kelly bag waterproofed. She would have to sit there all afternoon and wait for the rain to end rather than expose the bag to a droplet of moisture. It crossed my mind that she and her Kelly bag might have to sit there forever. Years would pass, and the rain would continue to fall. She would get old, although her Kelly bag would not. And eventually she and the bag would, like some modern version of Lot's wife, metamorphose into a monument to what happens to people who care too much about purses. Country songs would be written about her, and parables. At that point, I stopped worrying about purses and gave up. I came back to New York and bought myself a purse. Well, it's not a purse exactly, it's a bag. It's definitely the best bag I have ever owned. On it is the image of a New York City Metro card. It's yellow, taxicab yellow to be exact, and blue, the most horrible blue of all, royal blue. So it matches nothing at all, and therefore, on a deep level, matches everything. It's made of plastic and is therefore completely waterproof. It's equally unattractive in all seasons of the year. It costs next to nothing, $26, and I will never have to replace it because it seems to be completely indestructible. What's more, never having been in style, it can never go out of style. It doesn't work for everything, I admit. On rare occasions, I'm forced to use a purse, one that I hate. But mostly I go everywhere with my MetroCard bag. And wherever I go, people say to me, "I love that bag. Where did you get that bag?" And I tell them I bought it at the Transit Museum in Grand Central Station and that all proceeds from it go toward making the New York City subway system even better than it is already. For all I know, they've all gone off and bought one, or else they haven't. It doesn't matter. I'm very happy. Serial Monogamy, a Memoir. My mother gave me my first cookbook. It was 1962, and I began my New York life with her gift of the Gourmet Cookbook, Volume 1, and several sets of sheets and pillowcases, white, with scallops. The Gourmet Cookbook was enormous, a tome, with a gloomy reddish-brown binding. It was assembled by the editors of Gourmet magazine and punctuated by the splendid, reverent, slightly lugubrious pictures of food the magazine was famous for. Simply owning it had changed my mother's life. Until the book appeared in the 50s, she had been content to keep as far from the kitchen as possible. We had a wonderful Southern cook named Evelyn Hall, who cooked American classics like roast beef and fried chicken and a world-class apple pie. But thanks to the Gourmet Cookbook, Evelyn began to cook chicken marengo and creme caramel. Before long, my mother herself was in the kitchen whipping up Chinese egg rolls from scratch. A recipe for them appears on page 36 of the book, but it doesn't begin to convey how stressful and time-consuming an endeavor it is to make egg rolls, nor does it begin to suggest how much tension a person can create in a household by serving egg rolls that take hours to make and are not nearly as good as Chinese takeout. Owning the Gourmet Cookbook made me feel tremendously sophisticated. For years, I gave it to friends as a wedding present. It was an emblem of adulthood, a way of being smart and chic and college-educated where food was concerned. But I never really used it in the way you're supposed to use a cookbook, by propping it open on the kitchen counter, cooking from it, staining its pages with spattered butter and chocolate splotches, conducting a unilateral dialogue with the book itself, in short, by having a relationship with it. The cookbook I used most my first year in New York was a small volume called The Flavor of France. It was given to me by a powerful older woman I'll call Jane, whom I met my first summer in the city. She was 25, and she took me in hand and introduced me not just to the cookbook, but also to brie and vitello tonnato and the famous omelet place in the East 60s. In fact, the first time I went to the omelet place, which was called Madame Romaine de Lyon, I was a mail girl at Newsweek making $55 a week, and I almost fainted when I saw that an omelet cost $3.45. Jane also introduced me to the concept of one away. You were one away from someone if you had both slept with the same man. Jane had slept with a number of up-and-coming journalists, editors, and novelists, the most famous of whom, at the end of their one night together, gave her a copy of one of his books, a box of which was conveniently located right next to his front door. According to Jane, his exact words, as she made her way to the exit, were, "Take one on your way out." The night President Kennedy was shot, Jane was having a dinner party, which went forward in spite of the tragedy, as these things tend to do. Jane served as an appetizer celery remoulade, a dish that I had never before encountered and that remains a mystery to me. A few months later, I had a thing with someone Jane had had a thing with. Jane and I were now one away from each other. And interestingly, that was the end of our friendship, though not the end of my connection to The Flavor of France. The Flavor of France was the size of a date book, only 6 by 8 inches. It contained small blocks of recipe text by Narcissa Chamberlain and her daughter Narcisse, and large black and white travel photographs of France taken by Narcissa's husband and Narcisse's father, Samuel Chamberlain. I didn't focus much on the mysterious Chamberlain family as I cooked my way through their cookbook, and when I did, I usually hit a wall. For openers, I couldn't imagine why anyone named Narcissa would name her daughter Narcisse. Also, I couldn't figure out how they collaborated. Did the three of them drive around France together, fighting over whose turn it was to sit in the back seat? Did Narcisse like working with her parents? And if so, was she crazy? But the Chamberlains' recipes were simple and foolproof. I learned to make a perfect chocolate mousse that took about 5 minutes, and a wonderful dessert of caramelized baked pears with cream. I made those pears for years, although the chocolate mousse recipe eventually faded from my repertory when the creme brulee years began. Just before I'd moved to New York, two historic events had occurred. The birth control pill had been invented, and the first Julia Child cookbook was published. As a result, everyone was having sex, and when the sex was over, you cooked something. One of my girlfriends moved in with the man she was in love with. Her mother was distraught and warned that he would never marry her because she had already slept with him. "Whatever you do," my friend's mother said, "don't cook for him." But it was too late. She cooked for him. He married her anyway. This was right around the time endive was discovered, which was followed by arugula, which was followed by radicchio, which was followed by frisée, which was followed by the three M's, mesclun, mosh, and microgreens. And that, in a nutshell, is the history of the last 40 years from the point of view of lettuce. But I'm getting ahead of the story. By the mid-60s, Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Craig Claiborne's New York Times cookbook, and Michael Field's Cooking School had become the holy trinity of cookbooks. At this point, I was working as a newspaper reporter at the New York Post and living in the village. If I was home alone at night, I cooked myself an entire meal from one of these cookbooks. Then I sat down in front of the television set and ate it. I felt very brave and plucky as I ate my perfect dinner. Okay, I didn't have a date, but at least I wasn't one of those lonely women who sat home with a pathetic container of yogurt. Eating an entire meal for four that I had cooked for myself was probably equally pathetic, but that never crossed my mind. I cooked every single recipe in Michael Field's book, and at least half the recipes in the first Julia. And as I cooked, I had imaginary conversations with them both. Julia was nicer and more forgiving. She was by then on television and famous for dropping food, picking it up, and throwing it right back into the pan. Michael Field was sterner and more meticulous. In fact, he was almost fascistic. He was full of prejudice about things like the garlic press. He believed that using one made the garlic bitter, and I threw mine away for fear he would suddenly materialize in my kitchen and disapprove. His recipes were precise, and I followed them to the letter. I was young, and I believed that if you changed even a hair on a recipe's head, it wouldn't turn out right. When I had people to dinner, I loved to serve Michael's complicated recipe for chicken curry, accompanied by condiments and poppadoms, although I sometimes served instead a marginally simpler Craig Claiborne recipe for lamb curry that had appeared in Craig's Sunday column in the New York Times Magazine. There were bananas in it and heavy cream. I made it recently, and it was horrible. Craig Claiborne worked at the New York Times not just as the chief food writer, but also as the restaurant critic. He was enormously powerful and influential, and I developed something of an obsession with him. Craig, everyone called him Craig, even if they'd never met the man, was famous for championing ethnic cuisine, and as his devoted acolyte, I learned to cook things like moussaka and tabbouleh. Everyone lived for his Sunday recipes. It was the first page I turned to in the Sunday Times. Everyone knew he had a tech-built house on the bay in East Hampton, that he'd added a new kitchen to it, that he usually cooked with the French chef Pierre Frainy, and that he despised iceberg lettuce. You can't really discuss the history of lettuce in the last 40 years without mentioning Craig. He played a seminal role. I have always had a weakness for iceberg lettuce with Roquefort dressing, and that's one of the things I used to have imaginary arguments with Craig about. For a long time, I hoped that Craig and I would meet and become friends. I gave a lot of thought to this eventuality, most of it concerning what I would cook if he came to my house for dinner. I was confused about whether to serve him something from one of his cookbooks or something from someone else's cookbook. Perhaps there was a protocol for such things. If so, I didn't know what it was. It occurred to me that I ought to serve him something that was my recipe. But I didn't have any recipes that were truly mine, with the possible exception of my mother's barbecue sauce, which mostly consisted of Heinz ketchup. But I desperately wanted him to come over. I'd read somewhere that people were afraid to invite him to dinner. I wasn't. I just didn't know the man. I must confess that my fantasy included the hope that after he came to dinner, he would write an article about me and, of course, include my recipes. But as I said, I didn't have any. Meanwhile, we all began to cook in a wildly neurotic and competitive way. We were looking for applause. We were constantly performing. We were desperate to be all things to all people. Was this the grand climax of the post-World War II domestic counter-revolution? Or the beginning of a pathological strain of feminist overreaching? No one knew. We were too busy slicing and dicing. I got married. And I entered into a series of absolutely insane culinary episodes. I made the Brazilian national dish. I wrapped things in phyllo. I stuffed grape leaves. There were soufflés. I took a course in how to use a Cuisinart food processor. I even cooked an entire Chinese banquet that included Li Lum's lemon chicken. Li Lum was the chef at Pearl's, the famous Chinese restaurant where no one could get a table. If you did get a table, you remembered the meal forever, because there was so much MSG in the food that you were awake for years afterwards. Li Lum's recipe for lemon chicken involved dipping strips of chicken breast in water chestnut flour, frying it, plunging it into a sauce that included crushed pineapple, and dousing the entire concoction with a 1 ounce bottle of lemon extract. Once again, the recipe was from the Sunday Times column written by Craig Claiborne. Craig, of course, had no difficulty getting a table at Pearl's, and I looked forward to going there with him someday after we had actually met and become close personal friends. I'd gone to Pearl's once and was stunned to discover that it was not only impossible to get a table if you weren't famous, but that being famous was not enough. There were degrees of famous. There was famous enough to get a table, and then there was famous enough to get Pearl to come to the table to tell you the nightly specials, and then there was true fame, top-of-the-line fame, which was famous enough to get Pearl to allow you to order the sweet and pungent crispy fish. This is what it came down to in New York. You had to have pull to order a fish. I became a freelance magazine writer. One of my first pieces for New York Magazine was about Craig Claiborne and Michael Field, who turned out to be at war with each other. As a result, I met Craig Claiborne. And after the article appeared, he invited me to his house. What he served for dinner was not memorable, and in any case, I don't remember it. Then Claiborne came to our house for dinner, and I served a recipe from one of his cookbooks, a Chilean seafood and bread casserole that was a recipe of Leonard Bernstein's wife, Felicia Montealegre. I can't believe I remember her name, much less how to spell it. Especially given the fact that her recipe was a gluey, milky, disappointing concoction that practically bankrupted me. I don't think it was Felicia Montealegre's fault that Craig and I never became friends, but there was no question in my mind after our two meals that we had no future together. Craig was a nice guy, don't get me wrong, but he was so low-key that once I'd gotten to know him, I was almost completely unable to have even imaginary conversations with him while cooking his recipes. Around this time, I met a man named Lee Bailey, and I guess I would have to say that if there were any embers burning in the Craig Claiborne department, they were completely extinguished the moment I met Lee. Lee Bailey was a friend of my friend Liz Smith, who believed that everyone she knew should be friends with everyone else she knew. So one night, she invited us to Lee's house for dinner. Lee lived in the East 40s in a floor through below the ground, And what I distinctly remember about it was that it had some sort of straw matting on the walls that probably came from Azuma. And it was just about the most fabulous place I'd ever seen. It was simple and easy on the eyes and comfortable, but nothing was expensive. There was no art to speak of and no color at all. Everything was beige. As Lee once said, be very careful about color. And then dinner was served. Pork chops, grits, collard greens, and a dish of tiny baked crab apples. It was delicious. It was so straightforward and plain and honest, and at the same time, so playful. Those crab apples, they were adorable. The entire evening was mortifying. A revelation. A rebuke in its way to every single thing I had ever bought and every dinner I had ever served. My couch was purple. I owned a collection of brightly painted wooden Mexican animals. I had red plates and a shag rug. My menus were overwrought and overthought. Would Lee Bailey ever in a million years consider cooking the Brazilian national dish? Or Lee Lum's lemon chicken? Certainly not. It was horribly clear that my entire life, up to that point, had been a mistake. I immediately got a divorce, gave my ex-husband all the furniture, and began to make a study of Lee Bailey. I bought the chairs he told me to buy, and the round dining room table that seemed to be part of the secret of why Lee's dinner parties were more fun than anyone else's. When Lee opened a store at Henry Bendel, I bought the white plates, seersucker napkins, and wood-handled stainless flatware that were just like his. I bought new furniture, and all of it was beige. I became Lee's love slave, culinarily speaking. Long before he began to write the series of cookbooks that made him well known, he had replaced all my previous imaginary friends in the kitchen. And whenever I cooked dinner and anything threatened to go wrong, I could hear him telling me to calm down, it didn't matter, pour another drink, no one will care. I stopped serving hors d'oeuvres, just like Lee, and as a result, my guests were chewing the wood off the walls before dinner, just like Lee's. I began to osmose from a neurotic cook with a confusing repertory of ethnic dishes to a very relaxed one specializing in faintly southern food. The most important thing I learned from Lee was something I call the rule of four. Most people serve three things for dinner, some sort of meat, some sort of starch, and some sort of vegetable. But Lee always served four. And the fourth thing was always unexpected, like those crab apples. A casserole of lima beans and pears cooked for hours with brown sugar and molasses. Peaches with cayenne pepper. Sliced tomatoes with honey. Biscuits. Savory bread pudding. Spoon bread. Whatever it was, that fourth thing seemed to have an almost magical effect on the eating process. You never got tired of the food, because there was always another taste on the plate that seemed simultaneously to match it and contradict it. You could go from taste to taste. You could mix a little of this with a little of that. And when you finished eating, you always wanted more, so that you could go from taste to taste all over again. At Lee Bailey's, you could eat forever. This was important. This was crucial. There is nothing worse than having people to a dinner that they all just polish off, and before you know it, they're done eating, and dinner is over, and it's only 10 o'clock, and everyone leaves, and it's just you and the dishes. And that was another thing about dinner at Lee's. On top of everything else, he had fewer dishes to wash, because he never, ever served a first course or a cheese course. And if he served salad, it just went onto the plate along with everything else. And by the way, Lee never served fish, so I never served fish, And I'll tell you why. It's too easy to eat fish. Bim, bam, boom, you're done with a piece of fish, and you're right out the door. When people come to dinner, it should be fun, and part of the fun should be the food. Fish, and I'm sorry to say this, but it's true, is no fun. People like to play with their food, and it's virtually impossible to play with fish. If you must have fish, order it at a restaurant. You might think that having Lee as a real friend might have made it superfluous to have him as an imaginary friend, but you would be wrong. As I conducted my inner conversations with Lee about what to serve or what would be the perfect fourth thing to accompany what I was serving, it never occurred to me to pick up the phone and ask him. Lee was much too easygoing. He would just have laughed and said, "Anything you feel like, honey." He was in his way as close to a Zen master as I've ever had, and all of us who fell under his influence began with his style and eventually ended up with our own. I always secretly wished that Lee would include a recipe of mine in one of his cookbooks. He frequently came to dinner, and he was always fantastically kind about the food, but he never asked for any of my recipes. He did take a photograph of my backyard for one of his cookbooks, and he used my napkins and plates in the photograph, but of course I'd bought them at his store at Bendel's, so it didn't really count. Meanwhile, I got married again and divorced again. I wrote a thinly disguised novel about the end of my marriage, and it contained recipes. By then, I'd come to realize that no one was ever going to put my recipes into a book, so I'd have to do it myself. I included Lee's recipe for lima beans and pears, along with my family cook Evelyn's recipe for cheesecake, which I'm fairly sure she got from the back of the Philadelphia cream cheese package. A food writer who wrote about the book carped that the recipes were not particularly original, but it seemed to me she missed the point. The point wasn't about the recipes. The point, I was starting to realize, was about putting it together. The point was about making people feel at home, about finding your own style, whatever it was, and committing to it. The point was about giving up neurosis where food was concerned. The point was about finding a way that food fit into your life. And after a while, I didn't have to have long internal dialogues with Lee. I'd incorporated what I learned from him and moved on. Four things were not enough. I went to five, and sometimes to six. I liked salad and cheese, so I served salad and cheese. So there were more dishes to wash, so what? On the design front, I left behind beige, and as a result, I made all the decorating mistakes that are possible once you do. And I got married again, by the way. In the course of my third marriage, I have had a series of culinary liaisons. I went through a stretch with Marcella Hazan, a brilliant cookbook author whom I had a somewhat unsatisfactory connection to, with Martha Stewart, whom I worshipped and had long, long imaginary talks with, mostly having to do with my slavish adulation of her, and only last year with Nigella Lawson, whose style of cooking is very similar to mine. I gave up on Nigella when one of her cupcake recipes failed in a big way, but I admire her willingness to use store-bought items in recipes, her lackadaisical qualities when it comes to how things look, and her fondness for home cooking. I especially like making her roast beef dinner, which is very much like my mother's, except for the Yorkshire pudding. My mother didn't serve Yorkshire pudding, although there is a recipe for it on page 61 of the Gourmet Cookbook. My mother served potato pancakes instead. I serve Yorkshire pudding and potato pancakes. Why not? You only live once. On maintenance. I have been trying for weeks to write about maintenance, but it hasn't been easy. And for a simple reason, maintenance takes up so much of my life that I barely have time to sit down at the computer. You know what maintenance is, I'm sure. Maintenance is what they mean when they say, after a certain point, it's just patch, patch, patch. Maintenance is what you have to do just so you can walk out the door, knowing that if you go to the market and bump into a guy who once rejected you, you won't have to hide behind a stack of canned food. I don't mean to be too literal about this. There are a couple of old boyfriends whom I always worry about bumping into, but there's no chance if I ever did that I would recognize either of them. On top of which, they live in other cities. But the point is that I still think about them every time I'm tempted to leave the house without eyeliner. There are two types of maintenance, of course. There is status quo maintenance, the things you have to do daily or weekly or monthly just to stay more or less even. And then there's the maintenance you have to do monthly or yearly or every couple of years or so, maintenance I think of as pathetic attempts to turn back the clock. Into this category fall such things as facelifts, liposuction, Botox, major dental work, and removal of unsightly things, of varicose veins, for instance, and skin tags, and those irritating little red spots that crop up on your torso after a certain age for no real reason. I'm not going to discuss such issues here. For now, I'm going to concentrate only on the routine, everyday things required just to keep you from looking like someone who no longer cares. We're talking about hair, hair dye, nails, unwanted hair, exercise, and skin care. First, hair. We begin, I'm sorry to say, with hair. I'm sorry to say it because the amount of maintenance involving hair is genuinely overwhelming. Sometimes I think that not having to worry about your hair anymore is the secret upside of death. Tell the truth. Aren't you sick of your hair? Aren't you tired of washing and drying it? I know people who wash their hair every day, and I don't get it. Your hair doesn't need to be washed every day, any more than your black pants have to be dry cleaned every time you wear them. But no one listens to me. It takes some of my friends an hour a day, 7 days a week, just to wash and blow dry their hair. How they manage to have any sort of life at all is a mystery. I mean, we're talking about 365 hours a year, 9 work weeks. Maybe this made sense when we were young, when the amount of time we spent making ourselves look good bore some correlation to the number of hours we spent having sex, which was, after all, one of the reasons for our spending so much time on grooming. But now that we're older, whom are we kidding? On top of which, have you tried buying shampoo lately? I mean, good luck to you. Good luck finding anything that says on the label, simply, shampoo. There are shampoos for dry but oily hair, and shampoos for coarse but fine hair. And then there are the conditioners, and the straighteners, and the volumizers. How damaged does your hair have to be to qualify as damaged? Why are some shampoos for blondes? Do the blondes get better shampoos than the rest of us? It's totally dizzying. Shelf after shelf of products, not one of them capable of doing the job alone. I deal with all this confusion by taking draconian measures to reduce the amount of time I spend on my hair. I never do my own hair if I can help it, and I try my best to avoid situations that would require me to. Every so often, a rich friend asks me if I'd like to go on a trip involving a boat, and all I can think about is the misery of 5 days in a small cabin struggling with a blow dryer. And I am never going back to Africa. The last time I was there in 1972, there were no hairdressers out in the bush, and as far as I was concerned, that was the end of that place. I'm in awe of the women I know who have magical haircuts that require next to no maintenance. I envy all Asian women. I mean, have you ever seen an Asian woman whose hair looks bad? No, you haven't. Why is this? I once read an interview with a well-known actress who said that the thing she was proudest of was that she could blow dry her own hair, and I was depressed for days afterwards. I'm completely inept at blow drying my own hair. I have the equipment and the products, I assure you. I own blow dryers with special attachments and hot rollers and Velcro rollers and gel and mousse and spray. But my hair looks absolutely awful if I do it myself. So, twice a week, I go to a beauty salon and have my hair blown dry. It's cheaper by far than psychoanalysis and much more uplifting. What's more, it takes much less time than washing and drying your own hair every single day, especially if, like me, you live in a large city where a good and reasonably priced hairdresser is just around the corner. Still, at the end of the year, I've spent at least 80 hours just keeping my hair clean and pressed. That's 2 work weeks. There's no telling what I could be doing with all that time. I could be on eBay, for instance, buying something that will turn out to be worth much less than I bid for it. I could be reading good books. Of course, I could be reading good books while having my hair done, but I don't. I always mean to. I always take one with me when I go to the salon. But instead, I end up reading the fashion magazines that are lying around, and I mostly concentrate on articles about cosmetic and surgical procedures. Once I picked up a copy of Vogue while having my hair done, and it cost me $20,000. But you should see my teeth. Which brings me to hair dye. Many years ago, when Gloria Steinem turned 40, someone complimented her on how remarkably young she looked, and she replied, "This is what 40 looks like." It was a great line, and I wish I'd said it. "This is what 40 looks like" led inevitably to its most significant corollary. 40 is the new 30, which led to many other corollaries. 50 is the new 40, 60 is the new 50, and even restaurants are the new theater, focaccia is the new quiche, etc. Anyway, here's the point.